Workers Union warns an ongoing strike at the top three car makers will expand if no agreement on pay hikes is reached. This is news. Thanks for joining us. Tehran says five Iranian citizens imprisoned in the U.S. will be freed as Iranian assets frozen overseas due to unilateral U.S. sanctions are released. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said in his weekly presser that the prisoner swap with the U.S. will get underway later today. He said that Iranian citizens will be released in return for the release of five U.S. citizens held in Iran. Nasser Kanani also said that Tehran will get access to its unfrozen funds, which were held in South Korea later on Monday. Kanani added that the assets are now in a bank account in a regional country. The $6 billion were frozen due to the U.S. sanctions. The spokesman also stressed that Tehran is vehemently pursuing the release of other assets blocked overseas due to the U.S. sanctions. He slammed Washington for the brutal measures. Kanani also talked about the security deal with Iraq over the removal of terrorists from areas near the joint borders.
Many of the provisions of the agreement have been fulfilled so far, and the Iraqi government has followed up seriously. Some of the bases of terrorists and armed groups have been evacuated, and the terrorists have been transferred to other places, far from Iran's border and deep inside Iraqi territory.
Kanani said that Tehran is serious about ensuring the security of its borders and will not make any concessions in this regard. The spokesman added that Iran respects the Iraqi sovereignty and its territorial integrity, but he said the presence of terrorists in Iraq's Kurdistan region undermines Iran's border security. Masoud Shajara, chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, joins us from London. Welcome. When you take a look at the fact that Iran has been successful in releasing these prisoners through, I'm sure, diplomatic channels, which were very hard, given the fact that you're dealing with an entity that Iran does not communicate with directly, this is considered quite an achievement for this government's headed by Ibrahim Raisi. And it also reflects, of course, your thoughts here, how Iran does go after its citizens to ensure their safe return, whether it's to Iran or to whatever destinations they are at. How do you view this?
Well, this is significant. It's very important. And it's actually in line with what Iran has committed itself to its citizens since the beginning of the revolution. Prior to that, there wasn't really much interest in the protecting the citizens of Iran. But now we have seen since the revolution that has been one of the main commitments of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And the fact that this sort of exchange is taking place at the time when there is very little communication, no direct communication, it actually means that there is a very sophisticated sort of negotiation behind the scene indirectly, which resulted in this. And I think it really is good, because it's good for sort of those who have found themselves unjustly imprisoned in the United States. It's good to stop the sort of illegal and barbaric actions of United States in putting those sanctions on Iran and creating something which is a sort of a law of jungle, and enforcing and bullying the international community. It sort of shows that despite what the U.S. thinks, still it could be held accountable.
When it comes to this whole thing with the U.S. imprisoning Iranians, two of the key areas that they focus on usually is the fact that they were trying to evade sanctions they're what I can refer to, I think, as a tool, and that is the issue of human rights, where they twisted and then place, and that's combined with sanctions, and then go after imprisoning that particular person. What is the, how can Iran shield itself from illegal detainment of its citizens when it comes to, in particular, the U.S. and other countries?
I think it goes far beyond what is happening to Iran. It's barbaric and unlawful sort of policies of United States in bullying people around the world. I mean, the fact of the matter is that their sanction, which they have enforced, it's creating a huge problem in Iran, in Venezuela, in Cuba, in Russia, and many other places. The reality is that innocent people are dying as a result of shortage of medicine and medical equipment, and they keep on sort of bragging that this doesn't affect humanitarian sort of issues or humanitarian goods. But it does. Everybody knows it does. You know, they're bullying people that they don't even want to talk to Venezuela for any deal. Companies, sort of pharmaceutical companies, or with Iran or anywhere else, because they're being bullied systematically. Now, the solution to this is not just Iran doing this sort of deal, which indeed shows that the United States can't get away with it, but it's also people coming together, and we're seeing signs of that. We're seeing that what is happening with Russia, Venezuela, and everywhere else. People of the South are actually rising up and saying enough is enough. You can't go around bullying international community in this way and forcing their unlawful position on everybody else. And I think that is really becoming more vocal. And I hope that this will result in stopping United States behaving so badly as it has.
Thank you very much for that. Masoud Shajara, Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has departed for New York to attend the 78th session of the UN General Assembly. Addressing reporters ahead of his departure, Raisi underlined that his administration favors a world free from injustice and discrimination. He said that he will use the opportunity to be the voice of all Iranians. Raisi stressed that interaction with world countries, as well as regional, extra-regional, and international organizations, is a pillar of Iran's policy. He said meeting with several heads of state in order to enhance bilateral relations is on the agenda during his trip to New York. The Iranian president is scheduled to address the UN General Assembly on Tuesday. The Iraqi National Intelligence Service has broken up a terror cell that planned to carry out operations against population centers across the country. The agency says the terrorists were planning to execute suicide bombings against police stations, security checkpoints, and public markets in Baghdad and elsewhere. The agency says, however, that the recent Arbaeen processions were the main target. According to the intelligence body, the arrested terrorists have admitted to receiving military training on manufacturing explosive devices and belts and handling explosive materials. The agency identified the terrorists as remnants of Daesh Takfiris. Israeli forces have shot yet another young Palestinian man in occupied territories. The regime troopers shot the man at a checkpoint near occupied outposts for allegedly attempting to carry out a stabbing attack. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, was with us and gave us the details.
Now, the Israeli military issued a statement saying that a Palestinian, or a suspect, they said first, approached the checkpoint of Mazmouria, South Al-Quds, crossing from Sur Bahir village in Al-Quds, and that he had a knife with him. One of the Israeli forces there saw this man wielding a knife. He immediately opened fire directly at this Palestinian man, who was later identified as Palestinian, and they said they neutralized him. When the Israeli military say that they neutralize someone, then this means they used their guns to shoot and kill. They opened fire and killed the Palestinian. However, Palestinian Ministry of Health up till the moment didn't inform, had not been informed directly from the Israeli authorities that a Palestinian was shot and killed, or who is this Palestinian. They didn't reveal his identity. We are speaking about news and reports coming from the Israeli military. A Palestinian man had been neutralized. First, they said that he was shot and he was in serious condition. Then they said that he was neutralized.
The nearly daily incursions by Israeli settlers into the Al-Aqsa Mosque under the support of Israeli forces have long angered Palestinians. Such an act often leads to clashes between regime forces and Palestinians, who call the move illegal. To discuss the topic, we talked to our guests in our news review program. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Israeli forces have once again attacked protesters across the Gaza Strip, injuring at least 6 Palestinians, including 3 journalists. A number of Palestinians were wounded in the east of Rafah governorate along the border fence with Israel, as regime forces targeted protesters with live fire and tear gas. 3 Palestinian journalists were also injured by Israeli tear gas during a protest east of the town of Jabalia. The Palestinians were protesting against the ongoing Israeli aggression, including attacks on Muslim worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and occupied Al-Quds. Israel also recently launched airstrikes on the Gaza Strip, which it claimed targeted the positions of Hamas resistance movements. Ashraf Shannon is a correspondent joining us from Gaza City. We also have Muti Abu Musaba, who's a Palestinian political activist, joining us from Gaza City also. Welcome to you both. Ashraf, I'll start with you. Tell us about what has occurred there in the Gaza Strip first.
The Israeli forces shot and wounded at least 7 Palestinians, as well as 3 journalists working for international news agencies in the east of the enclave yesterday, as protesters, dozens of them, were expressing their anger at the atrocities and war crimes committed by Israeli forces and Israeli police at Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Al-Quds. Israeli forces used live fire and also used the so-called peaceful methods. We're talking about tear gas. They used tear gas canisters, high-velocity tear gas canisters, to hit protesters, and they mainly aim at Palestinian journalists, like what happened yesterday, and the same thing happened the day before, and also on Friday. Also on Friday night, following the protest, Israeli forces used drones to attack Hamas security posts in the area. The injuries and the attacks show the fact that the Israeli regime refuses to acknowledge that these young people are not armed. They are peaceful protesters. And I believe it's the fact that the Western countries, mainly the United States, their unwavering support for the Israeli regime has encouraged it to attack Palestinians, to cause pain and suffering to Palestinians wherever they are.
How much has the U.S. Or what kind of a supporting role has the U.S. played when it comes to the sufferings of the Palestinians? Muti Abu Musaba.
First of all, I would like to clarify that these protests actually come in the context of the normal response of the Palestinian people here in Gaza Strip to the ongoing and continuous Israeli crimes committed against the Palestinian people across all Palestinian territories. And these protests actually deliver and disseminate a clear message that the Palestinian people here in Gaza Strip, despite the dire conditions they are experiencing, they are living here as a consequence of the ongoing and the continuous Israeli siege imposed on Gaza Strip. They would never allow for the Israeli occupation to target each territory, each front in the Palestinian territories separately. Today, the main message of this protest is to reject the ongoing Israeli violations and abuses practiced against the Palestinians in Jerusalem and against the Palestinian prisoners inside the Israeli jails, which means that the Palestinian people are totally united. They are on the same boat when it comes to the struggle against the Israeli occupation, when it comes to face the cruelty of the Israeli occupation. We do understand and believe that these moments we are living and we are experiencing as Palestinians are decisive and sensitive. And we would never allow for the Israeli occupation to separate and isolate the Palestinian people in Jerusalem from other territories, Palestinian territories. This is on one hand. On the other hand, the way that the Israeli occupation forces target the Palestinian unarmed protesters near the separation fence, Eastern Gaza Strip, reiterates reiterates the fixed policy that the Israeli occupation has in dealing or regarding targeting the Palestinian people or responding to the Palestinian unarmed protesters near the separation fence. Sheds more light on the brutality and the cruelty of targeting the Palestinian civilians, targeting the Palestinian journalists and the Palestinian medics there. This means that the Israeli occupation still insists on targeting the Palestinian people in order to prevent those journalists from covering the reality on the ground.
Thank you for that, Mutiaba Msabe, Palestinian political activist from Gaza City, also from Gaza City, our correspondent there, Ashraf Shannon. Thank you, Ashraf. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. In the U.S., the main auto workers union has warned that a historic strike at the top three car manufacturers will expand if the companies do not agree on pay hikes and other labor issues. Finn added that members of the United Auto Workers are fed up with falling behind at a time when car manufacturers have been making a fortune. Thousands of auto workers walked off their jobs after their union failed to reach deals with the companies over a new labor contract. The union announced the strike at three assembly plants owned by General Motors, Ford, and Stellantis. They are known as the Detroit Three, and it's the first time in their history that they are hit by a strike. Automakers had offered a 20% pay rise over 4.5 years, which were less than half of the amount that the union had sought. And that is it for this edition of World News. Thanks so much for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In this episode, we invite you to listen to the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with the Supreme Assembly of Commanders and Officials of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, on August 17, 2023. In the Imam Khomeini Hosseinia. Imam Khomeini, with his perceptive insight, truly no better term can be used for him, which was an insight in the true sense of the word that penetrated the hidden layers of the matters and saw things that others could not see, said, "Whence all your shouts on the U.S.? So the reason for their enemy with this revolution has become clear. And it has also become apparent who the enemies are." There is another point that also needs to be mentioned about these enmities. If the Islamic Republic had not become a role model, there would have been less enmities toward it. But the Islamic Republic has become a role model. It has become a pioneer. The Islamic Republic has become the driving force of the resistance movement in this sensitive region. That is the issue here. These two is one of the important matters.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
YouTube, before the victory of revolution, the wretched Zionist regime was able to paralyze the armies of several relatively strong neighboring countries in just 6 days, countries such as Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. In the Six-Day War in 1967, the Zionist army was able to paralyze the well-equipped army of these three countries. It seized large parts of the land and took over hundreds of square kilometers of the lands of these three countries. The same thing happened in 1937, when Egypt and Syria initially used a surprise tactic to react. But they were immediately besieged again, and the Zionist army defeated them once again. In other words, three countries with their armies combined were unable to oppose the Zionist regime, and they were crippled in 6 days. After the Islamic Revolution, it came to the point where this same regime did everything it could for 33 days to defeat Hezbollah in Lebanon, but it failed and was forced to flee in disgrace. It was unable to continue against Hezbollah. The difference between the pre-revolution period and the post-revolution period is equivalent to the difference between the Six-Day War and the 33-Day War.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
$10 an hour, 5 years, seniority.
One of the striking auto workers in the U.S. Thousands of United Auto Workers are officially on a strike after three Detroit automakers failed to reach an agreement with the union.
What appears that now is going to happen is the UAW is planning targeted strikes across all three companies. So striking at just specific plants.
We're going to get to that story soon. But did you know that the U.S. is experiencing strikes in other sectors as well? From UPS, the carrier service, to Starbucks, the coffee chain,
we pull the shots.
We call the shots.
Workers at many U.S. companies are taking to the streets. In short, they are fighting for better pay and improved working conditions.
We have hotel workers on strike across the region, everywhere from the LA Grand, which joined the strike this morning, JW Marriott, Ritz-Carlton.
We have a very weak labor law. There are a lot of aspects of our economy and our politics that concentrate a lot of power in the hands of corporations.
And there may be more strikes to come. UPS employees started striking before reaching a deal. that would have involved some 340,000 workers. Close to 3,000 Starbucks workers protested what they called unfair labor practices. 1,400 members of the United Electrical Workers went on a strike after rejecting the company's contract offer. 6,000 workers at Boeing's Aerosystems went on a strike, also rejecting the company's contract offer. Add to that 80 Amazon drivers who protested unfair labor practices. And McDonald's employees in California went on a strike over paid sick leave. Well, it becomes evident how much of a common occurrence these strikes are. And we can't forget Hollywood. Here's Susan Sarandon, a famous Hollywood actress, who joined film and television writers on picket lines for better pay, health insurance, and improved working conditions.
Well, I've been here a number of times, and it always makes me feel optimistic because it means that there is a chance if we stick together that we can get justice, and that's what we're here for.
General Motors, Ford Motor Company, and Chrysler, well-known names in the car industry, brand names with record incomes, but not so for the average worker.
They should be paid more. The corporation is making billions of dollars, and these people have been with them, and the cost of living and stuff like that. They've been with this company 20, 30 years.
Tens of thousands of the United Auto Workers are officially on a strike. The three Detroit automakers have failed to reach an agreement with the union, which represents about 146,000 workers. One major issue on the table, workers' pay. The union has proposed 40% hourly pay increases over the next 4 years. The average U.S. auto worker on a manufacturing production line earns about $28 per hour as of August. That's up only $1 from the previous year. The problem began on an agreement that the auto workers made with the government, which bailed out the big three automakers. The problem is, the workers hired in 2007 or earlier earned an average of $33 per hour, but the ones hired after 2007 earn only $17 an hour. Why? Because this agreement was made as a goodwill gesture to help the automakers get back on their feet after the crisis. But now auto workers' hourly earnings have fallen 19.3% since 2007. And that is not fair as they see it. Even the U.S. politicians see it that way, like Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer.
The fight you are waging here is not just about decent wages and working conditions and pensions in the automobile industry. It is a fight to take on corporate greed and tell the people on top this country belongs to all of us, not just a few.
But strikes in the U.S. are happening at a more frequent pace compared to previous years. There were 424 work stoppages in 2022, including 417 strikes and 7 lockouts. Work stoppages increased by 52% from 2021 to 2022. The number of workers involved in work stoppages increased by 60% from 2021 to 2022. The number of striking workers as a consequence saw an increase. Since the year 2021, the numbers have been rising steadily, with 650,000 to have threatened to go on a strike so far this year. The strikes point to a deeper problem within the U.S. economy. Things are not that rosy when it comes to Americans' income and economic well-being. For example, homelessness has been on the rise in several states, most notably California, and also in New York City.
The unhoused population has exploded with the addition of the new arrivals. For example, here at St. Bartholomew's Church, where we start serving, we're seeing on average anywhere from 250 to 275 people, more or less regularly. Once the new arrivals started coming, our numbers got up over 400 people.
Thank you.
The UN Migration Agency, IOM, has raised alarm over the high number of migrants killed while crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. It has described the U.S.-Mexico border as the world's deadliest land route for migrants. At least 686 deaths and disappearances were reported in the border crossing last year. The figure represents nearly half of the 1,457 migrant deaths and disappearances recorded through the Americas in 2022, the deadliest year on record since IOM's Missing Migrants Project began in 2014. The data underscores the growing death toll and increasing risks that migrants face throughout the region. These figures represent the lowest estimates available, as many more deaths are likely to go unrecorded due to a lack of data from official sources. Nearly half of the deaths on the U.S.-Mexico border were linked to the hazardous crossing of the Sonoran and the Chihuahuan deserts, far more than other desert regions where irregular migration is prevalent.
The International Organization for Migration documented the deaths and disappearances of 686 migrants on the U.S.-Mexico border in 2022, making it the deadliest land route for migrants worldwide last year. The figure represents nearly half of the 1,457 migrant deaths and disappearances recorded throughout the Americas last year, the deadliest on record since the Missing Migrants Project began in 2014.
Hundreds of thousands of migrants and asylum seekers have taken long and perilous paths through South and Central America and Mexico in hopes of reaching the U.S. border to apply for protection. Many are fleeing rampant gang violence, poverty, political persecution, and other crises in their home countries. This is while the U.S. is accused of ignoring the plight of migrants. From an economic perspective, it is the U.S. that benefits from the contribution of migrants to the nation's GDP. Many of those immigrants that come to the U.S. through its southern borders end up working in farms and construction sites owned by big companies. It's been argued that increased immigration promotes U.S. economic growth and helps tackle labor shortages and inflation. U.S. President Joe Biden, who is under pressure from Republicans, has launched new restrictions and programs to discourage people from trying to apply for asylum at the frontier. The measures have been put in place amid record numbers of arrivals at the border since he took office in early 2021. The measures introduced by the Biden administration include a rule that disqualifies people from seeking asylum in the U.S. if they did not first apply in countries that they crossed earlier in their journeys. Rights groups have slammed the measure as an asylum ban. The Biden administration has also opened so-called safe mobility centers in Latin America to allow asylum seekers to apply for U.S. protection in third countries instead of at the border with Mexico. But migrants and asylum seekers continue to head to the border. For years, Central American nations have stepped up immigration enforcement efforts, often at the behest of the United States, erecting new obstacles for the steady stream of people making the journey north. The journey is plagued with violence, with areas under the control of criminal networks and armed groups.
The Darien Gap, an inhospitable jungle border crossing between Panama and Colombia, saw 141 documented migrant deaths in 2022. The remote and dangerous nature of this area and the presence of criminal gangs along the route means that this figure likely does not represent the actual number of lives lost.
The surge in arrivals has piled political pressure on the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden, whose Republican rivals have accused him of causing chaos at the border. In 2021, U.S. authorities reportedly detained 1.7 million migrants trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border.
Let me be clear. The lifting of the Title 42 public health order does not mean our border is open. In fact, it is the contrary. Our use of our immigration enforcement authorities under Title 8 of the United States Code means tougher consequences for people who cross the border illegally.
Marking an all-time high and highlighting the deepening political and humanitarian challenges the Biden administration is facing on immigration, the U.S. has been increasingly reliant on Mexico to stem the flow of migrants. As it returns to Mexico, the majority of people who arrive at the border under a Trump-era border restriction enacted due to the coronavirus pandemic.
President Ebrahim Raisi has underscored Iran's full authority on its recently released assets. Raisi said it is the Islamic Republic that decides how to spend the funds and that the money will be spent, quote, wherever we need it.
This money belongs to the Islamic Republic of Iran, and naturally, we will decide, the Islamic Republic of Iran will decide to spend it wherever we need it.
So if I hear you clearly, that it will be used for more than humanitarian purposes, in your view?
Humanitarian means whatever the Iranian people needs. So this money will be budgeted for those needs. And the needs of the Iranian people will be decided and determined by the Iranian government.
Raisi made the remarks in an exclusive interview with the American broadcast television network NBC in the capital, Tehran. He pointed to the last month's deal between Iran and the United States to exchange prisoners and to secure the release of $6 billion of Iranian funds that had remained blocked in two South Korean banks since 2018 because of U.S. pressure on Seoul. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden claimed at the time that the funds and the proceeds of Iranian oil sales to South Korea could only be spent on humanitarian purposes.
The system is set up such that this money, these funds, can only be parceled out for humanitarian purposes.
The Biden administration has announced that it had taken concrete steps to clear the way for the prisoner exchange and also issuing a waiver that allows international banks to transfer the $6 billion to Qatar without the threat of U.S. sanctions. The waiver means that European, Middle Eastern and Asian banks will not be in violation of U.S. sanctions in converting Iran's money, which was frozen in South Korea, and transferring it to Qatar's central bank, where it will be held for Tehran. Top Iranian officials have emphasized that there is no connection between the prisoner exchange agreement reached with the United States and the release of Iran's frozen assets. U.S. sanctions have mostly targeted Iran's sale of crude oil and its ability to engage in dollar transactions in the global banking system. The Iranian funds were illegally blocked under the pretext of U.S. sanctions. Meanwhile, Iran's permanent mission to the United Nations has confirmed that five Iranians detained illegally in the United States on charges of circumventing U.S. sanctions will soon be released as part of a prisoner swap deal between Tehran and Washington. The five Iranian detainees were identified as Kaveh Lutfullah Afrasiabi, Mehrdad Muin Ansari, Amin Hassanzadeh, Reza Sarhangpour Kofrani, and Kambiz Attar Kashani. The prisoner exchange agreement was officially announced on August 10th, following 2 years of indirect negotiations between Tehran and Washington. In a gesture of goodwill, Iran has moved four American detainees from prison to house arrest. They joined the fifth American who was already under house arrest in Tehran. Meanwhile, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has expressed the Islamic Republic's readiness to negotiate last year's draft agreement aimed at salvaging the 2015 nuclear deal, also known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action or the JCPOA, and removing illegal U.S. sanctions. Amir Abdollahian underscored the current administration's efforts to neutralize Western-led sanctions against the Islamic Republic while keeping the window open for negotiations to remove the illegal U.S. bans. The United States, under former President Donald Trump, abandoned the JCPOA in May 2018 and reinstated sanctions that the agreement had lifted. The talks to revive the 2015 deal kicked off in the Austrian capital city of Vienna in April 2021 with the intention of removing anti-Iran sanctions and examining the U.S. seriousness in rejoining the JCPOA. The discussions, however, have been at a standstill since August 2022 due to Washington's insistence on its hard-nosed position of not removing all the sanctions that were slapped on Tehran by the previous U.S. administration.
What the Americans want to do is have a JCPOA where they don't abide by their commitments in full, and the Iranians do so. And the Iranians are not going to have that again. When Obama signed the deal, he systematically violated the deal from day one. And then Trump tore up the deal. And Biden, despite criticizing Trump, he pursued Trump's maximum pressure policy, which was directed at ordinary Iranians.
Iran has consistently said that it has not left the negotiations with the Western side and that it was the United States which has blocked the talks with its excessive demands.
Iran's leader, addressing thousands of people from the provinces of Sistan and Balochistan and South Khorasan. He also said the U.S. and Europe do not have the same powers as before and are declining. The leader may be referring to the rise of powerful blocs like BRICS or the SCO. BRICS in particular has just recently expanded from its current 5 members to include new members like Iran and Saudi Arabia. And here's a map of the world outlining BRICS countries. It is pretty obvious how the U.S. and Europe are the minority. U.S. intervention in other countries' affairs, whether through wars, regime change, or economic sanctions, has led to the polarization of the world. The leader called the U.S. failure in Syria and the humiliating escape from Afghanistan two obvious examples of the decline of American power. It's a toss-up between which of these two failures were more humiliating. Right now, the U.S. is occupying Syria, looting the country from its oil, and selling it to provide for his troops there, and by many accounts, to support the terrorists in northern Syria. That is a low for any country. A big slap in the face to France and colonialism. From Mali to Niger to Gabon, African countries are rising against the colonial country France, which has held these countries captive economically. But the people of these countries have now risen, saying that enough is enough. Iran's leader has said you hear these days how the African countries that were under the influence of France are rising against it one after another. Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader stated that Washington is working on ethnic and sectarian fault lines in Iran with the aim of creating a crisis in the country. Some of the areas that he outlined, called crisis points, are ethnic differences, religious differences, and the issue of gender and women. But this is something that the U.S. has executed for quite some time. Back in the year 2007, it was revealed that the CIA was funding ethnic separatist groups to create instability in Iran. These incidents were carried out by the Kurds in the west, the Azeris in the northwest, the Ahwazi Arabs in the southwest, and the Baluchis in the southeast. The incidents included bombing and assassination campaigns against Iranian soldiers and government officials. There was also the Iran Freedom Support, an act of Congress approved by the former U.S. President George W. Bush that appropriated millions of dollars to spend money in support of groups opposed to the Iranian government. Iran's leader statements have come at a time when there is an intense campaign to turn the unfortunate passing away of Mahsa Amini's one-year anniversary into a violent one.
The commission is the premier UN body for promoting gender equality and empowering women. It cannot do its important work if it's being undermined from within. Iran's membership at this moment is an ugly stain on the commission's credibility.
One member, a bullying member, notorious for disobeying the UN Charter and international law, intend to pursue its unlawful request to remove an elected member from the commission only on the basis of unfounded claims and fabricated arguments.
This is IRIB English Radio. IRIB English Radio.
with you every single moment.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
Everybody, and perhaps most, have heard of life of Sheikh Ansari and his ascetic circumstance. Was it not for the circumstance, he would not be able to train those great students and would not be able to write those invaluable works and present them to the society.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Dear listeners, welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. Well, on the subject of prayers, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh said, perform the Friday congregational prayers as well as other prayers with splendor. The evils or shayateen are afraid of the prayer and mosque. You know, this speech of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh is about Friday congregational prayer. In the Holy Book of Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has clearly commanded the faithful to take part in the Friday prayer. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, O you who have faith, when the call is made for prayer on Friday, hurry toward the remembrance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and leave all business that is better for you, should you know. Surah Al-Jum'ah, verse number 9.
صلي على طه النبي وآله
صلى الله عليه
صلي على
رسول الله
يا ربنا صلي على
You know, great rewards for congregational prayer have been mentioned in the hadith as well, some of which have been cited in this way, that the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam is reported to have said that the prayer of one who hears the adhan but does not participate in the congregational prayer of Muslims for no justifiable reason at all is worthless. It is stated in a hadith that disparaging congregational prayer is tantamount to disparaging God. Congregational prayer is a prelude to unity among the ranks, closeness of hearts, and promotion of the spirit of brotherhood. It is a kind of informal attendance check and the best way of identifying individuals. Congregational prayer is the largest, purest, and most economical gathering in the world, and it is a sort of free-of-charge meeting, familiarity with each other's problems, and a platform for social cooperation among Muslims. So it is very good for each one of us to try our best to participate in this great event and beautiful gathering. Okay, that's the time we've got for today's episode. For ending, let's just recite the sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh about prayer. In that regard, he has said, perform the Friday congregational prayers as well as other prayers with splendor. The evils or shayateen are afraid of the prayer and mosque. Thank you very much for being with us in today's episode. Until another episode, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day.
every night and every day. Never forget to say La ilaha illa
on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to another edition of Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we'll look at the news story which has a direct relevance to the beautiful religion of Islam, and we'll break it down from a Muslim perspective. France has sparked outrage across the Muslim world after introducing an abaya ban for all students. The abaya is an important dress item for Muslim women, a key part of implementing modesty and protecting their honour. However, French authorities believe it is somehow contrary to the state's secular values. This is far from the first time French authorities have targeted Muslim females and their clothing, but activists fear the Islamophobic policymaking won't stop with the abaya.
Take it off or go home. That is the choice many female Muslim students had to make when entering school in France. After the French authorities introduced a new ban on a popular loose-fitting clothing item worn by Muslim women known as abaya. The controversial move has received huge condemnation from across the Muslim world and is seen as the latest act of aggression by an Islamophobic regime in Paris, which pushes a strict interpretation of radical secularism onto religious minorities.
The abaya has no place in our schools, no more than any other religious symbols. At the heart of this is conforming to our principles of secularism and neutrality.
The abaya is a simple, loose overgarment, essentially a robe-like dress worn by Muslim women. Traditional abayas are usually black and may either be a large square of fabric draped from the shoulders or head or a long kaftan. The concept of hijab in Islam is compulsory, but it isn't just about covering the hair, but also a woman's body and natural curves. The abaya is a popular way to ensure the concept of hijab is observed by women. On the first day of school following the ban, some 300 women defied it, with onlooking French teachers demanding they undress from the robe or go home. Many chose to leave instead. Amid public outrage and a growing protest movement, French President Macron defended the ban.
Schools in our country are secular, free and compulsory, but foremost secular, and religious signs, whatever they are, do not have a place.
Some have called the ban oppressive, others hypocritical, especially when France has a long history of trying to force its values onto the Muslim world. A policy which spans hundreds of years of French imperialism.
Well, joining us today to talk about the oppression of Muslims in France, we have two esteemed guests. Issa Ali is a freelance journalist who worked with RT as their correspondent for 7 years. His specialism is West Asian affairs. And joining us on Skype is Sister Ibtihel, a humanitarian, climate and youth activist in France who has felt the effects of the discriminatory policies against Muslim women. Welcome to you both. Now, before I come to you, Issa, I want to speak to you, Sister Ibtihel, in France. Just tell us about some of those negative effects that you faced as a result of the Islamophobic policymaking that's become very commonplace in France now.
Well, while many children were getting ready to go back to school, we were kind of shocked, but not surprised, with this new abaya ban in schools that was announced by the new education minister. Unfortunately, France has a long history of exerting domination through control of bodies, and it has happened in the past, in 2004, with the hijab ban in school, and then the niqab ban in the public spaces in 2010, followed by the burkini in some municipalities in 2016, few years ago, we were speaking about the long skirt and now this new abaya band that is following the same pattern. So it's been around 20 years now. We have a constant pressure on Muslim women to police their bodies and tell us what we should wear and how we should wear it.
And perhaps you could just tell us, for example, if there are any non-Muslims watching, what is the abaya exactly? Why is it important for Muslims, and how does it fit in with the concept of hijab in general?
Yes, so first of all, the abaya is not a religious garment. It is a cultural outfit, as reminded several times by many leaders of the Muslim community. Overall, this controversy has exposed the double standards that racialized students are subjected to. How do we define the abaya? How do we differentiate it with the long dress, with the black dress, with the another color dress, with the long skirt, except by linking it to the race or alleged religion of the student? And on the ground, the student being harassed could be wearing just a dress or just a skirt or just a coat. As long as they are perceived as Muslim and wearing modest clothes, they are a victim of this harassment campaign.
Well, Issa Ali, let me bring you in now, because you know a little bit of what the French have been up to for quite some time now, especially in its treatment of Muslim minorities. Just tell me why you think that at this stage the French authorities are deciding that the abaya is the next thing that needs to be targeted here. What's the real issue here? They say it's about protecting their secular identity, but is that actually the case?
Well, France has a long history, of course, of hostility to Muslims, and you mentioned it there in your introduction. You know, going back to colonialism, the centuries long colonialism that France has practiced in Africa in general, but also specifically on Muslim communities in that part of the world, imposing their beliefs, imposing their language, imposing their currency. Still to this day, there are at least a dozen French countries that are still using the franc currency, which France itself isn't using anymore. There are, you know, countries like Tunisia and other places where that hostility towards Islam and towards Islamic dress is still implemented, even though it's a Muslim country. So this can be, you know, traced back to that colonial need to undress women, in particular undress Muslim women, because, you know, the gaze of the colonialist needs to be upon everything. And they somehow feel threatened because, of course, they are not, you know, I'm not talking about in general French people, but of course the colonialists and the people who are behind these policies, they seem to have a very sick and perverted vision of women and their ownership over them, because it's ironic, right? They say that, oh, Muslim men are, you know, protective over their women, or they are, you know, possessive. But it's exactly the same thing, even worse actually, because you're seeking to take away that female sense of autonomy over themselves. And so that's the first step of this. This is just the latest line in a long history of French aggression towards women, towards Muslims, towards Muslim women in particular. And it also speaks to an insecurity in France as well. If we look on the geopolitical level, we're seeing a number of African countries liberating themselves, kicking out their dictators or their puppet leaders, and installing governments that are outwardly and openly anti-French. They're demanding the French leave their region. Some of those countries are Muslim African countries. And so perhaps this is some type of, you know, very weak attempt to push back against that. But one thing that we've seen, you know, every action has a reaction. And in France, the one thing that always impresses is that the French community, the Muslim French community, always seem to be very strong and outspoken. So even despite all the pressure that's on them, they're always the ones who are at the forefront of that. It would be good for Macron, the former Rothschild banker, to remind himself that his population contains many millions of Muslims and Africans, and if he wants to push too far, there will be a backlash, like the types we've seen over the last 12 months, the huge pro-democracy protests, the huge anti-Macron protests that we've been seeing. So something for him to keep in mind as well.
Absolutely. And sister, let me come back to you. Obviously, you're living there in France now. You know what the situation is like on the ground. Issa said something about, you know, it's not necessarily all French people that support these types of policies. It's about perhaps some, you know, post-colonialist right-wing elements in the government. But what I want to ask you is that, you know, people are electing those policymakers in France. Is this a case where the wider French public seems to have issues, deep-rooted issues with Islamophobia, or is it just a few bad apples in government that are pushing through these policies that are not necessarily so popular?
I think it's more the state in itself and the institutions that are Islamophobic, following with the media that is controlled as well by the state. And because of all that, everything that is shown on media and the ignorance leads to fear and leads to hatred, maybe. But by